Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Last month, the USDA ordered the recall of more than 140 million pounds of beef after workers at a plant in California were found using electric shocks and forklifts to move cows to slaughter that were too sick or too weak to stand on their own. For those people who are concerned with food safety, it was yet another example of a system in need of reform. This morning on Focus 580, we'll be talking with one of the country's leading experts on food and drug regulation. His name is Michael Taylor. He's research professor at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services in Washington, D.C. We'll look at the government agencies responsible for food safety and talk about what might be done to make them more effective. And, of course, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions are welcome. We do ask, however, people to be brief in their comments so that we can keep things moving along here and get in as many people as possible. Just let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Michael Taylor. He chairs the Food Safety Research Consortium. That is a multi-university effort to improve food safety priority setting and decision-making. Between 1994 and 1996, he served as administrator of USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service, and before that was deputy commissioner for policy at the Food and Drug Administration, and also FDA staff lawyer and executive assistant to the commissioner. In the private sector, he established the food and drug law practice at King & Spalding. He was vice president for public policy at Monsanto, and he has a law degree from University of Virginia. As we talk this morning, questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455. We do also, again, have that toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can give us a call, and we'd be happy to hear from you. Professor Taylor, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Well, good. Rainy day here on the East Coast.
Well, we appreciate you talking with us again. I should mention that our guest was here. I believe that it was last summer, before last, would have been the summer of 2006.
I think that's right.
And at that time, I think that the story that got people thinking about this was the spinach issue,
right?
That there was some spinach that was found to be contaminated and. It gets to this question and it comes up periodically, that we have real concerns about the possibility of foodborne illness and how we need to respond to that. And when one of these stories comes along, you know, people like me start calling people like you, and it gets attention and it gets written up in the news. But I think that it probably is worth mentioning that for people like you, people who work in this area of policy, who are concerned about the government role in food safety, these kinds of concerns have been up for discussion now for quite a few years.
Yes, these issues continue, and events happen. They don't always come to prominent national attention. And you're right, it's when these issues do come to national media attention that the policy process begins to turn over, the reform process here in Washington. And I think, fortunately, that process is underway now. But no, we've known for example, in the case of the produce and the contamination with E. coli and other bacteria in produce, we've known about these problems for 10 or 12 years. We just haven't gotten really the effort together to be as preventive as we need to be to put in place the controls. And I think finally, again, processes are underway that I hope will lead there. But it's a long course to get fundamental reform of a system that's been around for a long time, has very entrenched practices, and does need fundamental reform.
Yeah, and we will, I'm sure that at some point we'll talk about some of the ideas and some of your thoughts about how things might be changed. But I think it is worth making the point here at the beginning that one of the problems with the system that we have now is that it is very fragmented, and we have many different entities within the government. I mean, basically the big ones, I suppose, would indeed be the Food and Drug Administration and the USDA. But there are a lot of other pieces of this system It's very fragmented, and there is no. I listened to a talk that you gave last December, on this subject, and basically you said the big problem here is that there's nobody in charge. There's no one person who has oversight capability for this large and complex system.
Well, that's right. It is a very fragmented system. You mentioned the Food and Drug Administration and USDA. In addition, the Environmental Protection Agency, interestingly, really makes more decisions about the safety of chemicals in food than either FDA or USDA through its program regulating pesticide residues in food. But even if you look within USDA, for example, there's the Food Safety and Inspection Service, which conducts inspection in meat and poultry slaughter and processing plants. But then there are food safety research functions that are elsewhere within the Department of Agriculture, not really accountable to the people responsible for the Food Safety Inspection Program. And then from an authority standpoint, the Food Safety and Inspection Service in USDA, which is responsible primarily for food safety regulation, has no authority to regulate on the farm. That rests in the hands of another USDA agency, which doesn't really have food safety authority. So it's a real patchwork and an obsolete patchwork of agencies that really, as you say, leaves the system with no one in charge. You've got USDA overseeing 20% of the food supply, FDA 80%, but again, no one in charge of the big picture, and a lot of issues fall through the cracks as a result.
Yeah, and one also sort of stunning reality, another one of these things that just leaves you scratching your head, when you take a look at that ratio, that is the USDA regulates 20% of the food supply and the FDA regulates 80%. If you look at the amount of resources that the two agencies get, it's completely disproportional to the size of the job that we've given them.
Exactly. So USDA with 20% of the food supply under its responsibility has two-thirds of the resources, and that's because it's required by law to conduct this carcass by carcass and daily inspection of processing plants without regard to where the relative risks are and what would be the best use of those resources. So FDA has 80% of the responsibility and 80% of the problems, really, in terms of foodborne illness outbreaks, but only one-third of the resources. So it's a system that's out of balance. Nobody would have designed it this way if they were starting from scratch. It's evolved over many years. It needs to be fundamentally overhauled in many respects.
Yeah. And another thing, and this I love this example because it says something about how responsibilities are fragmented. The USDA is responsible for meat and for poultry, and the FDA is responsible for just about everything else, including things like eggs and milk. So the example is frozen pizza with sausage on it. Who's responsible for that?
Well, that would be USDA. Anything with 2% or more meat or poultry.
Oh, if it's got enough meat on there, then it becomes USDA responsibility.
Right. So chicken noodle soup is USDA. Noodle soup is FDA. Cheese pizza is FDA. Pepperoni pizza is USDA. and because of the way the system is set up, that pepperoni pizza plant is going to be inspected every day by a USDA inspector. That's after the production of the pepperoni has been inspected every day, and after the cattle, you know, the production of the meat itself, the slaughter was inspected. And a pepperoni pizza plant, quite frankly, because of the temperatures involved, is not a high-risk operation. On the other hand, the cheese pizza plant, you know, FDA on average would inspect every 10 years, and in practice would, you know, may never inspect. So there's just no rationality at all to the way the resources are deployed. It's all a function of this very obsolete set of statutory mandates, particularly on the USDA side.
Yeah. It's interesting to think a little bit about how these agencies came to be and what sort of problems they were created to address.
Right.
And they have been, the USDA, I think, has been around for something like 100 years and the FDA for maybe about 80, and that they were, particularly USDA, was created to do one thing, and now it seems really the problem that we have, the big concern here, is indeed foodborne illness, and it's stuff that it's bacteria, it's and things like E. coli, stuff that you can't see.
Right.
And the system that we have was not set up to deal with that kind of problem. It was set up to deal with something else.
Right. Well, the carcass by carcass slaughter inspection system was really followed on the Jungle, the book by Upton Sinclair, in the early part of the 20th century. you know, where the problem documented was sort of gross contamination and diseased animals coming into the food system. And so this carcass-by-carcass sort of veterinary inspection system is very good at protecting against that, although I must say we have seen a recent failure in that system. But the fact is that you know, as you indicate, the problems really are different today. Generally speaking, the animals coming into slaughter plants have a high degree of uniformity and are generally quite healthy. The problem is the invisible bacteria, and this visual, century-old mode of inspection obviously is incapable of dealing with the bacteria, which are the cause of foodborne illness.
And just to touch on this most recent story, I think that this was the result of an undercover investigator who was sent into this plant under the auspices of the Humane Society.
Right.
And I think that one thing that a lot of people reacted to was the way that the animals were being treated, and it does indeed go to this concern of humane treatment of animals. There is, however, behind that the more serious concern that these kind of cows that they call downer cows, the ones that seem not to be able to walk or not to be able to stand, that could be symptomatic of a condition like BSE, like
right.
mad cow. So, and that's definitely, we don't want that to get into the food system. So here again, it does go back to this idea of a foodborne illness kind of problem that is not something that you can pick up just by taking a look at the carcass after that animal has been slaughtered.
Right. And this point about so-called downer cattle and the importance of being very careful about them and not allowing animals that are at risk of BSE or mad cow disease to come into slaughter plants. This is a very important issue, and it needs close scrutiny. I mean, what I think this latest huge recall, based upon both the mistreatment of animals and the possibility of downer cows being entered into the plants, really is, though, a function of the obsolete statutory mandate that USDA has, because in order to satisfy the statutory mandate, there's a very rigid set of practices that the USDA inspectors have to follow in the plants, again, mostly focused on disease that is not evident from the condition of the animal, you know, when it walks into the plant, but that is, again, looking at matters that have very little relationship to food safety. But USDA's resources go almost entirely into that in-plant inspection activity when, depending upon the circumstances, it would be much better to have the flexibility to be able to deploy those inspection resources outside the plant to check for downer cattle, to go upstream to inspect at the point of production and feedlots and so forth. But it's this rigidity of the statutory mandate that locks this almost $1 billion worth of food safety resources going to USDA is locked into these obsolete tasks, and the managers of that agency do not have the flexibility to deploy resources in ways that are most likely to protect the public, to reduce the risk of illness, and to protect against the things we all want to protect against.
Yeah, and I think that definitely goes to the point that the kind of problems that we're concerned with now are complicated, and there are little things that perhaps happen all along in the chain from the beginning point, or from the person who raises the animal, all the way through to the way the animal is handled and the way the processing is done, and then how eventually things end up getting to the consumer at the end point. There are a number of things that can happen all along that kind of chain, and really to address the problem, you have to look at all those points all along the chain.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we've learned over the last decade and more, that if you really want to be preventive about foodborne illness, which I think most people would agree is the right goal of the food safety system, we want to prevent foodborne illness, we have to take what's often referred to as a farm-to-table approach, because as you indicate, there are points all along the spectrum from production on the farm, whether it's animals or produce, where potential hazards, contamination can come in. And all through the system, these opportunities occur for bacteria either to enter the system, to grow and increase if not maintained in the right temperature, to be reduced by interventions that can reduce or eliminate bacteria. But we have to look at the system in a holistic way. And that's where, again, the statutes and authorities and the fragmentation of the agencies, food safety agencies, really precludes that holistic preventive farm-to-table approach, which in 1998, the National Academy of Sciences issued a landmark report which really called for this sort of systematic farm-to-table preventive approach and much more science-based and risk-based deployment of resources. And that was, you know, that wasn't a new insight 10 years ago. But again, it's taking us a very long time to sort of turn the system over and really get to that kind of preventive farm-to-table approach.
Yeah. Let me introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580, Michael Taylor. He is a research professor at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services in Washington, D.C. He also has worked in both the USDA and the FDA. He served as administrator of USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service, that from 1994 until 1996, and also before that, he served as deputy commissioner for policy at the Food and Drug Administration. We're talking this morning about food safety in the United States and the systems that are set up, the governmental system set up to try to assure the safety of the food supply, and where some of the problems are, and perhaps how things might be changed so that those systems will work better. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think one of the criticisms that you have, and a lot of other people have, is that we have focused now on responding to problems once we become aware there are problems, and that what we ought to be doing is to put more of our resources into prevention, so prevent problems from happening in the first place. Having said that, also, I think that there seem to be some questions about the kind of authority that the agencies have to issue recalls if they think that there is a problem.
Well, this whole idea of being preventive rather than reactive, I think, is at the heart of the reform debate, and I think the shift that I certainly believe, and I think a lot of people believe needs to happen, is a shift from a system that is fundamentally reactive to one that is fundamentally preventive. It always will remain important to be able to react swiftly and effectively when problems occur, and we're never going to eliminate food safety problems entirely. So, you know, the ability to recall product promptly, to remove it from the marketplace once we found a problem, that is very important. One of the areas in which we have had real progress, though, in terms of developing scientific tools, is in the ability to detect problems after they've occurred, to detect outbreaks of illness. There are new systems that the regulatory agencies, FDA and USDA, and the Centers for Disease Control have collaborated along with state and local health people, to be able to do molecular fingerprinting, for example, of bacteria detected and cultures taken from people who've become sick, and permitting illnesses to be linked to a common source so that a nationwide pattern of illness can be detected linked to a common source, which can drive the necessary recalls of product and corrective action. So that's a good thing, and I think we need to build on that, but that's just indicative of the kind of science that is available also to learn about how to be preventive. And so, again, you look at something like the produce problem, the lettuce, spinach issues with E. coli. What I think everybody really agrees is we've got to be preventive at the point of production on the farm, and FDA really needs authorities and research capacity and a whole lot of tools to be able to provide leadership to be preventive on the farm, something that the produce industry has actually asked for. They want enforceable standards, preventive standards for safe production of leafy green vegetables and other produce on the farm, and that's something the system has to get geared up to provide.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about what you would like to see happen here. I know that what you're suggesting is that there really ought to be, we ought to kind of, I don't know if it's too strong a word to say, scrap the system we have now, but take it and dramatically change it, consolidate the whole thing, and actually create a specific agency. With so that there will be clear lines of responsibility and authority, and there will be some person who is in control, some kind of new thing that we would call the Federal Department of Food Safety or something like that.
Right. Well, I really see three major elements to the needed reform, and the starting place is the statutory mandate, is the legislative charge and the authorities that the food safety agency or agencies are given by Congress. And this really means, as we've been discussing, giving the food safety agencies an explicit mandate to be preventive, the legal tools to do that, to set standards and enforce standards that are designed to prevent problems, and a clear mandate and authority to deploy the resources in a science-based way that's going to get the most risk reduction bang for the buck. Without that overhaul, and it really is an overhaul of the statutory mandate for the food safety system, organizational change won't be of significant benefit. We should not start with organizational change. We should start with modernizing the legislative mandate. The second element is resources, because while we do put $1.5 billion into the FDA and USDA programs, and that's a lot of money, there are many ways, particularly when you look at the challenge of a globalized food system and the huge volume of imports coming into this country, the need for us to expand oversight so that we're more cognizant of what's happening in foreign countries. I mean, there is a need to increase resources. And FDA's program in particular is really, really, really in desperate need of resources. Its resources have actually been declining in real terms over the last decade or so. So modern mandate, resources, and then if you've got those elements in place, then absolutely we need to come up with a structure that permits a single body to have the authority and the responsibility, the accountability for overseeing the food system and the food safety efforts in a unified, holistic way that, again, is coherently working to find opportunities to prevent risk of illness all across the system. And that, again, that can't be done most efficiently, certainly, if you've got multiple agencies dividing up responsibility for this system. It is really a system that has to be addressed holistically by a single agency in the end.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, we know, as you point out, that now we do have a globalized food system. If people have been reading some of the news lately, they also will now understand, if they didn't before, that we also have a globalized pharmaceutical system,
right?
And we have a globalized system for a lot of other products. And that seems to me to put even greater pressure on USDA, the FDA, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, those departments of the government that are particularly responsible for looking at products that have come into the country, various kinds of things, food and drugs and toys and who knows what all else, have come from outside the United States. It seems that we're going to have to, if we're really concerned about this kind of safety and dealing with the repercussions of this global economy that we have, that in all of these kinds of efforts, we're going to have to start putting more money into them. There'll have to be more money, and we're going to have to hire more people.
Yeah. Well, there's a long history of the American public certainly valuing the role that FDA or the Consumer Product Safety Commission plays, but in some ways taking it for granted, just assuming that the protective efforts are there. And in an ideal world, you'd like people to be able to take it for granted because those efforts would be there and there would be the level of oversight that people expect and that is necessary. The problem is that as the public has taken for granted the capability of these agencies, the political system has not only taken it for granted, they've actually allowed these agencies to erode in their capacity to do this kind of oversight. The Consumer Product Safety Commission you mentioned, is half the size it was in 1980 when, again, you've got a set of challenges from a globalization standpoint that are much greater than 1980. As I mentioned, FDA, in its ability on the food side and also the pharmaceutical side to do the kind of foreign plant inspections that are needed. I mean, resources have actually eroded. So we've got this very tough situation where we've allowed these agencies to decline at a time when the job is getting more difficult. So, it is a matter of more resources. It is also, to some extent, a matter of will, political will, to really give these agencies the charge to do the kind of rational, science-based, but, fully protective oversight that people expect and that public health really depends on.
Well, this is obviously dealing with another subject, but yesterday the Senate apparently did approve a bill that would overhaul the Consumer Product Safety Commission.
Right.
And this is now, it's got to be reconciled with something that has come through the House, which is apparently not as strong. So, who knows what's going to end up here. But I think that it's interesting that it's significant that it happened. It no doubt indicates that there is not only concern on Capitol Hill, but there is public concern. And because of that, I wonder whether, in fact, at some point here, Congress is also going to have to look, not like they haven't been looking at it, but have to look more closely at the agencies that we've been talking about at FDA and USDA, and look at these some of these same issues when it comes to either food products or this other thing that now we're hearing about, and that is pharmaceuticals, that particularly that come out of outside of the United States.
Yeah, no, I think there's no question that needs to happen, and it is beginning to happen. Actually, Senator Durbin from your state has been a leader over the years in the Senate on food safety. He's had legislation that he's introduced in, you know, over the years, and I think will be one of the leaders to bring about reform, you know, in the coming, you know, months and years. And you're seeing Senator Kennedy as well in the Senate, who chairs the committee that oversees FDA. Congresswoman DeLauro in the House, Chairman Dingell, Chairman Waxman. I mean, the leadership is focusing in on this subject, and it's always hard to predict the timing or certainly the outcome of a legislative process. But I think for the first time, what we're really seeing is a consensus coming together that includes not only these congressional leaders, but key constituencies. The food industry has realized and has been public in expressing its call for strengthening FDA's oversight of the food system. Certainly, the consumer groups are in that same position, and with a lot of commonality in the direction of the reforms, again, towards this more systematically preventive approach to foodborne illness. So I think these news events that you mentioned earlier in the broadcast have finally catalyzed the process that I see gathering steam. And I'm more optimistic now than I've been really ever that we have the opportunity to achieve some very significant reform over the next year or two. Mm.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of the show, Michael Taylor. He's research professor at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services in Washington, D.C. He also chairs the Food Safety Research Consortium. That's a multi-university effort to improve food safety priority setting and decision-making. He, between 1994 and 1996, worked at USDA as administrator of food safety and inspection, and before that as a deputy commissioner for policy at the Food and Drug Administration. And questions are welcome. Here we're talking about the food safety system and how perhaps it might be improved, restructured to make it function better. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you're listening on the internet anywhere in the country, you can use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, I think it's interesting, you talked about the fact that back at the time that agencies like USDA, FDA were created, that as far as food was concerned, a big issue was the concern was adulteration, contamination, and they weren't so much concerned with the issue of bacteria because they apparently thought, well, if people cook their food, that would take care of that problem. If you look at now, though, some of the concerns we have, particularly going back to some of the concerns about not only food but other sorts of products, adulterated products, things that have contaminants in them, not bacteria, but other sorts of things. I wonder if we're actually going to go back to having to actually also have that concern too, and that maybe now it's not going to be one or the other. We're going to have to actually be paying a lot of attention to both these things.
Well, that's a very important point. You know, the concern about chemical residues in food, for example, really came to the fore in sort of the middle of the 20th century as pesticides began to be used more widely in agriculture, and then you know, a lot of innovative chemical technology in food processing and that provided benefits to consumers also you know, raised questions about safety, and as a result, a whole pre-market approval system for food additives, for example. I mean, these issues don't go away, and we need to not lose sight of them, and we need to be sure that we've got the tools to deal, you know, with them equally well. So it is not an either-or proposition. It's just that what we've really seen, and it goes back to the you know, the jack-in-the-box outbreak of illnesses associated with E. coli in ground beef sold at the jack-in-the-box chain out on the West Coast back in the early 90s. you know, where we just we're really, and again, it was one of those events that brought an issue that had been there, you know, to public attention in a very transformative way, and it really, that really did, I think, for the public, put the issue of bacteria on the radar screen, and I think there's rightly been a much greater focus on that over the last, you know, since that time in the early 90s. But again, it's not that these other issues go away. We still have environmental contaminants, mercury as an air and water pollutant that gets into seafood. Again, number of issues that persist that have to be taken care of in a very careful way.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, and we'll do that as someone in Savoy, not too far away from us here, line number one. Hello.
About what's going on in this country, was curious about how that compares to Canada or other industrialized Western nations.
Mm-hmm. Well, good question. It's interesting that if you look at Canada and also look at Great Britain in the aftermath of the concerns they had there about mad cow disease and E. coli, there actually has been some important structural reform where they have unified many of their food safety functions under one agency. And you know, some of the reforms that are being talked about here have been pursued, and I think to good effect in Canada and the UK. The other kind of famous example of a different approach, which again may not be entirely transferable to the United States, but in some of the Scandinavian countries, there's a much greater focus on on-farm preventive efforts, particularly with salmonella in poultry, where in Denmark, for example, I mean, they've put in place measures that essentially have eliminated salmonella contamination of poultry, something that we're not close to doing yet here in this country. And so there are lessons to be learned about how to be more preventive, you know, on the farm with respect to some of these problems as well. So I think there are definitely lessons to be learned.
Now, if you're going to take a guess that our food is safer here than some of these other countries, where do we kind of fall on the spectrum of food?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the honestly, there's not a simple, straight answer to that, and I think I don't. And in fact, maybe the best answer is nobody really knows. And we like to say that we have among the safest food supplies in the world. We like to say that we have among the strongest food safety systems in the world. I think the fact is we do some things very well. I think the food additive, you know, pre-market approval system works, is very rigorous and effective. You know, you could look around and look at examples, as I just mentioned, of other countries that are moving towards a more modern preventive approach, and you know, more rapidly than we are. So again, I don't think the point should be that people should panic about the safety of the American food supply. Most people eat safely every day, and you know, there's a lot of good, you know, solid work that goes on in our food safety system every day. My concern is that the people working in that system, who understand these problems and want to be taking these more preventive approaches, are hamstrung by obsolete statutes and inadequate resources and structures that really don't work. And so the point is, and I think this is where the public rightly raises concerns, is that we're not doing what we know is possible to do to reduce the risk of illness further. And so it's that gap between what we know is possible and what we're actually doing that I think creates the loss of public confidence in the system and lost opportunities to protect public health.
Well, again, I'd just like to give our telephone numbers for our people who are listening if you'd like to call with questions. The numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, the toll-free 800-222-9455. And again, our guest is Michael Taylor. He's a research professor at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services in Washington, D.C. You've talked about the fact that we ought to be putting more emphasis on prevention, and that the parties that are in the best position to do that really are the producers on the farm, and also the food industry that handles the product and processes it and does everything that has to do to get it into the form, to get it into the hands of the consumers.
Right.
Just talking about the what goes on the farm, what exactly are we talking about? Are we really talking about making the farmer's job more difficult and making it him have to spend more money on handling the animals? What exactly are you asking farmers to do?
Well, the issue, and let's focus on produce, and you know, coming out of the spinach experience and what we've learned from that, Again, these are products that are not cooked; they're eaten fresh. And what we know is that once the product is contaminated with the harmful bacteria, such as E. coli, on the farm, it is very difficult to eliminate the contamination and the risk of illness through subsequent processing. Subsequent processing is necessary, and there are efforts made to clean it up. But once contaminated, it's very hard to really eliminate the risk. And so I think what we're talking about is putting in place measures that reduce the risk. Again, you're not going to be producing under pristine conditions, but for example, preventing either livestock or wild animals from coming through production fields and leaving manure, and contaminating product directly in that way is a very basic protective measure, to reduce the risk of contamination. Likewise, water quality, the water either through runoff or from use in irrigation, if it's contaminated, and there are ways through testing and all to verify the condition of that water. We need standards to ensure that the water is not contaminating the product, and so there are a number of basic preventive measures that, again, is not, we're not going to achieve zero risk here, but where we recognize that those producers are as much a part of the food safety system as operators of processing plants for meat and poultry have been part of the food safety system for many years. And so, it's got to be done in a smart way. We probably need better science than we've got to devise the tools, the preventive measures that are going to be effective and that also are not unduly costly. So there's work to be done. But I think the basic principle that we've got to find ways to be preventive on the farm is very fundamental to the future of the food safety system. Mm.
I imagine processors would remind us that they're under a lot of pressure to provide a product and maybe a very wide range of products at a very affordable price, and that the profit margin in some of these industries is wafer thin, and Americans, of course, have come to expect this wide range of product at a very affordable price. Is what we're talking about, particularly if we're saying to the industry, we think that you ought to bear greater responsibility for food safety, should we expect that is going to be reflected in the price, and that for this greater safety, we should be willing to pay more for our food?
Well, you're quite right that the cost consciousness of the food system is an important reality, and I think makes decisions about investing in food safety difficult for some companies. There are a number of companies who have understood as a business matter that, I think particularly in the ground beef industry, there's been enormous investment in food safety because these companies realize that it's in their business interest to maintain public confidence in their products to make those investments. And they've done that. And I think they would say that has improved their business and including their profitability. I think part of the thing to keep in mind is that, yes, any additional food safety efforts will incur costs. I know that when I was at USDA and we implemented this new system of preventive controls in meat and poultry plants, requiring companies to have a system of preventive controls, and concerns were raised about the cost of that. And when the analysis was done and was costed out, it came out to a penny or so at most per pound of product. So it's not a zero impact, but it's a fairly modest impact when you spread these costs across the huge volume of production coming through the system. There are definitely concerns about small businesses and small, smaller scale processors, and a lot has been done when efforts have been made to elevate standards to assist small companies and to give them more time and give them technical assistance. And so you have to work with these cost realities, no question about it. But again, I think the American public has made it pretty clear that if there's things that reasonably can be done to reduce the risk of illness, they really should be done. And when the public discovers that we're not doing things we know we can do to make the food safer, the response is pretty harsh. And so, again, in the case of the produce industry, they want government-mandated enforceable standards on the farm because they've seen that the loss of business when consumers, for example, stop buying spinach you know, far outweighs any incremental cost, and I think they're right about that.
Yeah. We talked about earlier about this resource issue, and again, you've said several times here that what we really need to do is put more resources into the food safety system. We also talked about the fact that here, while there's this odd way that the resources that are there are allocated in that we have the two big agencies, FDA, USDA. The FDA oversees about 80% of the food supply, and yet they get about a third of the resources we put into this. Well, USDA, they oversee about 20% of the food supply, but they get two-thirds of the resources. So I imagine you're talking about more than just taking some of that money from the USDA and giving it to the FDA, that overall we're going to have to be spending more money?
Yeah, I think overall we should be spending more money. I think, you know, realistically, in the short term, and by that I mean the next 3 to 5 years, I think what you're going to see is a focus on improving FDA's program as a step towards the ultimate reform of the system. The political inertia around taking food safety out of the Department of Agriculture and combining it with FDA so that you can put these programs together, I think that's going to take some time to overcome. From a public health standpoint and a public confidence in the food supply standpoint, it is urgent that we fix FDA's program, and a big part of that is resources. As I indicated, they need a modern statutory mandate as well and new authorities. But there is a desperate need for FDA to have additional resources, and I think even their resource level is about $500 million for all that they do on food regulation, including food safety. I think realistically, to do what's expected, and particularly considering imports, I mean, they need to double that resource over the next 3 or 4 years. I think the numbers, a lot of room to debate the numbers, but you know, if we had a total of $2 billion going in instead of 1.5, and if that grew over time, and to keep up with rising costs, and if those resources could be allocated in a rational way, a cost-effective way, then I think you could really have an effective system. So I think there are overall, if you look at the system as a whole, a need to increase total resources, but deploying the resources better is equally important.
Mm-hmm. What sort of sanctions does the government have now to bring to bear on processors or companies or distributors who are found to be in violation of the rules that exist? I mean, just what sort of a stick does FDA, USDA have?
Well, this is again a big problem for FDA in particular. Its legal tools, again, for doing this basic food safety job, go back to a 1938 set of amendments to the law, and so they're allowed to go into food processing plants and inspect, and take samples of product, but they do not have authority to examine the company's food safety records to see exactly what how the company's system is working. If they find a problem with product, they can go to court and get a seizure order from a court to take the product out of commerce, or they can try to get the court to issue an injunction. But they do not have administrative authority to detain product. The states have that authority; the federal government does not. They don't have any authority to impose administrative penalties, fines on companies who violate rules. So again, it's a cumbersome judicial process, and they don't have a clear mandate and authority, as I said, to establish these regulations that require preventive measures of the company. So they really are, FDA really is handcuffed with a lack of tools, to take effective steps to be preventive. As you mentioned earlier, FDA also does not have authority to mandate recalls. Any FDA food recall is a voluntary act by the company. FDA can request it or suggest it, but it's a voluntary act by the company. So, again, in many ways, the legal toolkit is obsolete, as you would expect, since it was established in 1938, far before we were concerned about microbial pathogens, far before we had such a globalized food supply.
Yeah, it's as I recall it, I think that it is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the FDA only has mandatory recall authority on one product, and that's infant formula. Is that right?
That's right. Although, actually, there's also a provision. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Again, that's because there was a controversy about infant formula but 20 years ago, and amendments were passed to give FDA a much stronger hand, and you know, any modern regulatory statute is going to have some form of mandatory recall authority. So we've got it for infant formula, but not for other foods.
That seems remarkable to me that FDA doesn't have that kind of authority, or does have that kind of authority only on this one product. And I would assume that you would argue that FDA should have that kind of authority.
Well, I think it should. I will say that the system of voluntary recalls has, you know, generally works fairly well. I mean, most companies, if FDA says there's a safety problem with your product and we think it should be off the market, most companies act very quickly. It's not a legalistic process, and they get the product off the market. But on other occasions, companies might not be so responsive. And I think to back up a voluntary approach, which, again, if you can get a quick voluntary action, that's all to the good, but I think certainly FDA should have, as backup to that, the authority to mandate a recall if a company does not promptly, you know, take voluntary measures to correct a problem.
Yeah. Just I want to remind people listening that we have maybe about 5 minutes left in this part of the program, and we're talking with Michael Taylor. He's one of the country's leading experts on food and drug regulation. He is a research professor at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. That's in Washington, D.C. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, again, you know, we've talked about a number of things here. We've also talked about the fact that there is increasing awareness that we do indeed have a problem here. It is something that people in the scholars and scientists and people who work in USDA and FDA and Congress have been talking about for a while now, and that there have been some proposals made to do exactly what we're talking about here, and admitting that is a process that can take time. It can take years for something like that to happen. Do you, in fact, though, think that there's enough momentum behind this now so that we should start to see some move in this direction?
I do think that there really is a strong new consensus on the need for legislative change. And again, that includes the food industry and the consumer groups and the expert community. And I think there's an increasingly strong consensus on the nature of that change. And it includes strengthening FDA's authority to be preventive, to put in place standards and requirements that would work towards preventing problems on this farm-to-table basis. And so, you know, work is going on right now to draft legislation. I think because it's a long-standing program and a lot of complexity to it, I think, you know, it's a challenge to get that done. We're in an election year. It's unpredictable, as always, in an election year whether major legislation like this can happen. It will only happen, I think it's fair to say, if there's a strong bipartisan consensus, and you be the judge of the likelihood of that. But you know, any effort that can be made this year, I think, is all to the good and lay the foundation for, if it doesn't happen this year, next year. And I personally am very optimistic that if we don't get significant legislation this year, that we would get it in 2009. I think the time has come. People recognize that, and I think the work is going on to try to design that legislation, and hopefully in a way that will make the progress we want.
Mm. In just to go back and pick up again on one point we did touch on, the fact that we now know that an increasing amounts of the food that we eat come from outside of the United States. And that also, I think now, as we said, because of some recent stories, people are going to become aware that also some pharmaceuticals and over-the-counter medicines and other kinds of health and beauty aids also end up coming from outside of the United States.
Right.
That where exactly does the responsibility lie in terms of assuring the safety of that product, it particularly when there's no way that, even though some of this does happen, I guess, there was really no way for inspectors of the U.S. government to go to all of the places where these products are made to be able to inspect the plants and the processing facilities that those things come out of.
Right. But I think the to achieve the level of safety and confidence and safety we want for imports, we really have to look at a system that will achieve that. I think you raise an important point. Who has the primary responsibility for assuring that goods imported to this country from overseas meet our standards? And in keeping with the principle that it is the food industry, whether domestically or internationally, that makes food, that can make it safe, it is primarily the industry's responsibility. The government's role is to set standards and provide enforcement of those standards. So for imports, one solution, and I think actually the food industry in some elements is embracing this idea, the importer, the business entity responsible for bringing the food in, should be responsible for being able to demonstrate to FDA the way in which that food was produced, where it came from, and demonstrate that it was produced under conditions that meet U.S. standards. To back that up, FDA needs much more authority, not just to check the product when it, at the port of entry, which is really all FDA is legally empowered to do now, is check the product when it shows up at the port. FDA also has to be empowered to go to the foreign processing plant to check on the assurances it gets from the industry, to do its own inspections. I mean, today, FDA can inspect foreign food facilities only with the permission of the company in the foreign country. FDA cannot exclude product, imported product from the United States based on a foreign processor's denial of inspection, which again is just, you know, means that FDA doesn't have the basic tools it needs to provide oversight, to provide the enforcement that, that we need. So, you know, we need stronger importer responsibility, we need more authority for FDA to inspect overseas, and then we do need to work with foreign governments so that they elevate their own oversight, that they have standards and they do their own inspection and enforcement, so that all of these elements work together, really, to elevate the assurance that, that people expect, to meet the level of assurance that people expect.
Well, there we will leave it with our thanks to our guest, Michael Taylor. He is research professor at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services in Washington, D.C., also former administrator of USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service, and also he served for a couple of years as the Deputy Commissioner for Policy at the Food and Drug Administration. And Professor Taylor, thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
This program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates offers four area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. We'll take a break as we usually do. When we come back, the next hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the origins of language with Christine Keneally, author of a recently published book, The First Word. Right now, though, we'll break for an update on the markets and news, so please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. But first, this audio from the 2008 All-Day Agricultural Outlook meeting is now available on our website, WILLAG.org. Click on the link in the right navigation pane. The meeting was made possible by the Andersons Cargill and the Archer Daniels Midland Company. Let's go right to the prices. We're in Kansas City. March wheat is trading at 11.43 down 27. July, 11.26 down 14. At the Chicago Board of Trade, March wheat trading at $11 down 14. July, 10.66.5 down 8.5. March corn, 5.36 down 21. May, 5.47.25 down 20. July, 5.59 down 20. December, 5.59.5 down 19.75. March beans, 13.73 down 70. May, 14.08.75 down 50. July, 14.21 down 50. November, 13.11.5 down 50. March soybean.